Session number 6612, reel 1.
Colonel Ford Walker, reel 1. Colonel, can I ask you first why you joined the army?
Well, I joined the army really because I think it was the influence of my grandfather, who was a colonel in the Royal Engineers, and I didn't know what to do when I was at Eton. And during my last year at Eton, the army had their annual manoeuvres in Sussex, where I lived, and I was taken round by a Brigadier Forster, who was the chief umpire and a great friend of my mother's, and he took me round in his motor car and I watched the manoeuvres, and the Brigadier was very good. He explained everything to me, and I think it was this really that made me decide I wanted to be a soldier. I'd been brought up in the First World War by tales of the First World War and had various relations who'd served, and I always had an admiration of the army, and this clinched the matter. So I went to my father and I said, can I be a soldier? And he was rather doubtful. And then I happened to meet a chap whom I enormously admired, who was at that time Major Arthur Smith of the Coldstream Guards. And so when I had made up my mind and got permission from my father to join the army, I got in touch with Arthur Smith and wrote to him, and he got in touch with the adjutant of the OTC at Eton, who happened to be a Coldstreamer, Billy Jolliffe, and he came round to see me, and he said, I've heard from Arthur Smith that you'd like to join the army. What about the Coldstream? So I said, well, I should be delighted if you'll have me. And eventually I received a notice from regimental headquarters, and it was like that that I became enrolled as a candidate for the Coldstream.
And this was before you had gone to Sandhurst?
This was before I went to Sandhurst. I then made up my mind that I should go to Sandhurst, and I left Eton a half before I should have done, so as to go to France to learn French, because I thought that would be very useful for me, and also my father was a great French speaker and a great lover of the French. And so I went to away from Eton for 3 months living with a French family, and then came back to Eton to take the army exam. And I took the army exam at Eton, and I was luckily enough to be awarded an army scholarship, on a cadet scholarship, largely, I think, from the fact that I did very well at the examination in French, and that is really how my army career started.
When did you actually enroll at Sandhurst?
I joined Sandhurst in the autumn term 1929, and I arrived there a rather frightened young man, because I had been filled up by my former schoolmates who'd been to Sandhurst of the toughness of Sandhurst. So I arrived, I remember being driven up to the new buildings at Sandhurst, and I felt rather like joining Dartmoor, because the buildings were rather austere, and I've been overawed by the tales that I'd been told, and I was met by a junior under officer who'd been at school with me, and he very nicely was very welcoming and carried my luggage into the new buildings. And I did not like Sandhurst very much because I'd been overawed by these tales. And the first thing that I found was that I couldn't understand a word that the non-commissioned officer's instructors told us. We were all assembled. We had a grenadier sergeant major, Sergeant Major Robinson, and we had a West Yorkshire second in command to the NCO instructors. The sergeant major talked very fast in army language, using initials for everything, and the Sergeant Savage from the West Yorkshire Regiment talked in broad Yorkshire, so none of us understood a single word of what we were told in the instructions. We found the system of discipline pretty severe, because with the cadet officers, the senior under officers and the junior under officers were pretty severe on us juniors or new boys, and the whole atmosphere was rather frightening. First thing that happened was we were marched down to the barbers and our hair was cut like convicts. We were then dished out with canvas clothing, army canvas clothing, which was exactly like the pictures that you saw of convicts. And for the first few weeks that we were there, we had to wear this canvas clothing, and we were drilled by these NCO instructors then in canvas clothing. And the whole atmosphere was one of breaking us in. I always used to think that they wanted to destroy our civilian spirits so they could then build up again a military spirit into us. Right, stop.
What was the general character of the military training you did?
Well, the military training was, I found, in afterlife, quite useless. I happened to have the misfortune of going at a time when the system of training was radically altered. Before I went, the whole object of the training of Sandhurst cadets was to turn out perfect private soldiers. When I went, this system had been altered, and they wanted bring a bit more intellectual training into it. So our instructors were army officers who were chosen to give instruction in intellectual subjects. They weren't very good at it. And still the rigid discipline of spit and polish of the old system still prevailed. Now, what Sandhurst did for me was to teach me to polish leather in an immaculate way and to clean my boots and buttons, but it taught me absolutely nothing about military leadership and the officer qualities that were required. That was done in my regiment, but not at Sandhurst.
Now, in 1937, you were sent to Alexandria as adjutant to the 3rd Battalion of the Coldstream. How did you get that appointment?
In 1936, I was an ADC to the Governor of Bombay, and I received a letter from my great friend who'd been my company commander in the regiment, Jack Whittaker, saying that he was about to take command of our 3rd Battalion, and would I like to be his adjutant. I absolutely jumped at this because I was very fond of Jack, and I knew that he and I had the same outlook and the same ideas, so I rushed off to my to the governor of Bombay and asked him if he would release me from being his ADC. And he said he would release me provided I could produce another Coldstream officer to take my place on his staff, which I proceeded to do. I then went back to England in 1937 and took over the adjutancy of the 3rd Battalion Coldstream Guards. We were stationed at Aldershot then in Barossa Barracks and were part of the Aldershot Command. And very shortly after that, we went to Egypt. Now, there'd been the system before the war was that there would be at least two Guards battalions in Egypt, one in Cairo and one in Alexandria. This was the only foreign station at that time that the Brigade of Guards had. We never went to India, and we never went to any other part of the empire. So in September 1937, we went out to Alexandria in a troop ship from Southampton, the Dunera, which was a new troop ship, with a battalion of the Suffolk Regiment who were going on to India. So we arrived in Alexandria and took over from a battalion of grenadiers commanded by Colonel Boy Browning, later to become the founder of the Airborne Forces during the war. We took over an old Turkish barracks. We took over Mustafa Barracks, and we were, military speaking, part of the Canal Brigade, which was stationed at Ismailia. But we had very little to do with them, except when we went on manoeuvres to the neighbourhood of Ismailia. Our job was to show the flag in Alexandria and, in an emergency, to protect the port of Alexandria, which had been earmarked as a base for the Royal Navy. It had been so used during the Abyssinian War, and our job was to look after the port of Alexandria and various vulnerable points within the city of Alexandria. We also had to liaise with the Egyptian army, because in accordance with the treaty that Great Britain then had with Egypt, we were, in some years' time, were going to hand over the responsibility for the defence of Egypt to the Egyptian army. So we had an Egyptian battalion affiliated to us whom we were supposed to help train. They weren't very good, and we didn't have very much contact with them, except for on social occasions. Right, stop.
Could you tell me a bit about the voyage from Southampton?
We went out from Southampton on the new troop ship, which we were the first troops to go on, it called the Dunera. And we were with a battalion of the Suffolk Regiment who were going on to India. The accommodation on board was comfortable enough for the officers, but was pretty uncomfortable for the soldiers, who slept in hammocks. And, of course, not being accustomed to hammocks, they found this very difficult. We went across the Bay of Biscay, where we had our quota of typical bad weather, and I well remember the Sergeant Major telling me that when the mess orderlies were bringing the breakfasts up from the galleys, one of the orderlies was seasick into the porridge bowl that he was carrying. However, he took no notice of this, and the porridge was delivered, and the soldiers enjoyed their breakfast. We had married families accompanying the soldiers, and the married accommodation was pretty uncomfortable and pretty cramped, and with the rough weather of the Bay of Biscay, conditions were pretty uncomfortable, with people women and children being seasick everywhere. I was ship's adjutant, and we used to have to go round and inspect the troop decks every day. And I remember going round with the second in command of the Suffolk Regiment, Major Freer, and as we went through the troop decks, there were two guardsmen puking their souls out over the rails. And being good soldiers, as we came past, they were called to attention and stood to attention. And Brigadier Freer said he'd never seen anything, Major Freer said he'd never seen anything like it in his life before, that such discipline should prevail.
Because the sense of discipline stopped them being sick.
Yes. Standing to attention while they were being sick.
So they continued being sick, yes, while they were at attention.
Yes.
That's even more disciplined.
Yes. We then went and we stopped for an hour or two at Gibraltar, where a few details got off, and then we went on. We went to Malta, where we tied up in Valletta Harbour. And my commanding officer wanted the soldiers to have a chance to have a look round, to go ashore and have a look round the old fortress of Valletta. So we had we laid on a conducted tour. While they were, the commanding officer and myself both joined the conducted tour. While we were looking across the harbour, a guardsman in the Irish Guards, who was attached to us, came up, not noticing who the commanding officer was. He nudged him on the shoulder and he said, "I say, mate, I think we could fall out now, the officer's not looking, and go to a pub." And my commanding officer said, "I think that would be a most improper procedure." And the Irish guardsman, realizing his faux pas, made himself very scarce. We then arrived in Alexandria, where we were mounted trams to go up to Mustafa Barracks, which was about 4 miles from the port and on the outskirts of the town of Alexandria. Right.
Now, you said that you didn't have much to do with the Egyptians except for going to tea parties with them, but did you have any serious attempts to train them?
No, the training of the Egyptian army at that time was under a British army mission, so we did not have very much to do with the Egyptian battalion who was attached to us. The only thing we did was we brought them up to our barracks so they could see demonstrations of how a British battalion worked. Mind you, there was a British tradition in the Egyptian army going back for many years, because the Egyptian army had been officered by British officers after the war with Arabi Pasha, and so there was, the Egyptians had got a British army tradition. What we saw of our Egyptian battalion was not at all inspiring. I went out one day to see them on a rope march, and following the marching soldiers were various open carriages in which the senior officers were sitting while their soldiers marched. Right, stop.
Were you able to do much training with your own troops while you were stationed in Egypt?
Yes, we had a lot of training. We had ordinary musketry training and barrack training within the barracks in Alexandria, and we used to go down to Ismailia, to a place called Fayed, to camp in the desert to do desert training. And we had very rigorous and intensive collective training in the desert. We also used to do musketry training on ranges just outside Alexandria at Abu Qir. And our standard of training in those days for the British Army was pretty good. And I think we were fit for war.
You say right. Rigorous training in the desert. What sort of exercise did that entail?
Well, the training in the desert consisted of, first of all, company training, warlike training, training for war on a company basis, followed then by battalion training, where the whole battalion used to go out and train and carry out various military exercises, such as occupying a defensive position, attacking a position, patrolling, and various other military exercises. And they always used to end up by our battalion taking on a battalion of the Cameron Highlanders, who were also in our brigade. And this was a great test for the ingenuity and ability of the commanding officers concerned. I well remember when we were exercising against, I forget which battalion it was, of the Cameron Highlanders, they caught us out when we were occupying a defensive position and we hadn't got sufficient outposts out. And then this was very caused great consternation that we should have been caught out. But we had our revenge because we found that towards the end of manoeuvres they were having a battalion concert in the middle of the desert, and we crept up and attacked them while they were having this concert. So I think the score was deuce. And there was a great deal of leg pulling between the two battalions. We got on very well with them, had a very good liaison with them. But I think Jack Whittaker was very pleased that he'd finally outwitted Colonel Cameron, commanding the Cameron Highlanders, and had got his own back for having been outwitted himself.
When you were doing your tactical training in the desert, were there important differences between what you were doing there and what you had been doing back in England?
Basically, the training was basically the same as we'd done in England. We trained for the attack and occupying a defensive position, approach, march, etc. But the great difference was in the ground. The terrain in the desert was quite different from the terrain round Aldershot and in the countryside of England, for which we were had previously trained. We had to learn how to make use of the cover that was in the desert. You would think, to start with, that there wasn't any cover in the desert. But in fact, there were wadis, which are stream beds and folds in the ground and those sort of features. And we were learning how to make use of these, whereas in England we'd made use of sunken roads, hedges, ditches, farmyards, etc. And that, I think, was the main difference. But basically, the same military principles applied.
So it was simply a different form of application.
That was it, a different form of application of military principles to a different form of ground.
What facilities were there for the troops to entertain themselves and find relaxation in Egypt?
Well, we were lucky because Alexandria was a very big city and was on the seaside, so the troops mixed with the normal population of the city and took advantage of the bathing facilities, and we had plenty of games, plenty of sport, particularly when the Royal Navy were in Alexandria, which they came in just before the war and made us their base. We had a very close liaison with them, and we were constantly having teams from warships, and we were sending teams out to play them at football, soccer, hockey, and rugger. And the officers used to come up and play squash. And the troops walked out with the local population rather the same way as they do in London or Aldershot. There was one thing that my commanding officer, Jack Whittaker, was a very enlightened chap, and he knew that one of the grave dangers which all British regiments ran was this question of venereal disease. So when the military authorities, being conscious of this danger, had organized a military brothel. And when the battalion arrived, Jack Whittaker called all the guardsmen together into the dining hall. There were no officers present other than myself and the medical officer. And he got the medical officer to give them a lecture on the dangers of venereal disease. And I remember feeling rather embarrassed attending this very descriptive and detailed lecture. And then at the end, the medical officer pointed out that if anybody wanted to go with a young woman, there were facilities which could ensure that they didn't run any danger of catching this horrible and offensive disease. There was a regimental brothel organized in the brothel area of Alexandria,